Hi, you are listening to the Empowered Parent Podcast with me, Dana Bell Tudors, speech pathologist, parent coach, and NLP practitioner. I am passionate and committed to supporting parents to be the very best they can be for the children they care for. My career has enabled me to meet and work with many inspiring individuals who have contributed positively to children's lives, either as parents, grandparents, aunties, uncles, friends, professionals, community members, and volunteers. The aim of this podcast is to bring their stories to you so you can learn from their experiences and also have an opportunity to have your story and voice heard by others. Only by sharing with each other can we learn together. It definitely takes a village to raise a child. So, let's get inspired, let's get learning, let's get started. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to the Empowered Parent Podcast. I'm so excited to have you on my podcast. You are a dietitian and a busy, busy mum of three children. And I've read on your bio that you are an ADHD-er yourself. Good nutrition and health are very important to you as a parent and as a professional, obviously. Your passion is in supporting people, especially neurodivergent individuals, around their relationship with food. And I'm sure many parents listening today will be interested to know how they can best support their children who are fussy eaters and any tips that you might have. And I know this is your passion area. And before we delve into that, would you please tell us a bit about yourself, who you are and where you are in Adelaide, and why the interest in food and dietetics for you?
Well, Donna, thank you so much for having me today. Like you mentioned, I'm exceptionally passionate about this and excited to be here today so we can chat about these things. As a start, I'm a dietitian based in Adelaide. I do feeding therapy with children as well, and I'm based at Glenelg Allied Health Clinic at the moment. In terms of how did I get into dietetics, I'm a late diagnosed ADHDer, which does change the platform for the listeners out there who are in the same position. You can understand, you reflect back on your life and you can really understand what influenced that. So as a neurodivergent myself, we come with superpowers, and my superpower is really caring about people and emotional sensitivity. So I feel people's feels and I love to help people.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Also, there's a lot of dopamine in helping people. So I first got interested in nutrition in high school. My home economics, I'm not even sure if they call it home economics anymore, showed us the food guide pyramid. And I started to realize that food was affecting my body. And I have a big interest in biology and the human body as well. So all those factors together then developed the interest. But interestingly enough, together with that, I was a binge eater. Understanding now, this is the ADHD. I come from a family of compulsive eaters. And so this really was, wow, I want to learn more about what's causing this and you know, why do we react like this, but not everyone in the family. So you can see there's a genetic factor, and that got me really excited as well. And I ended up in a dietitian's office looking to enhance my sports performance. And that's where I got into it. Ironically, then, while I was studying dietetics, my whole class diagnosed me with a binge eating disorder. And understanding now that that was actually dopamine seeking as an ADHDer. And our neurochemistry and the way our body engages with its world directly affects the way that we engage with food. And here I am today with a neurodivergent husband and 3 neurodivergent children, and I'm able to share my knowledge and insight with others. So that's where I am right now.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah.
What an asset. You're an asset to the world. So how important are meal times for you as a parent, and how do you juggle your busy schedule and preparing healthy meals for your neurodivergent family?
Yeah, so as a start, having a background in nutrition and understanding the deep importance that nutrition has in our development in children and as humans, going into parenthood, I had to adjust my expectations on how I was going to feed my family, because we understand neurodivergence engage with food, and there are challenges associated with that. So I really had to adjust my expectations for mealtimes and understand that as my children develop those skills of mealtime behavior, food relationship, they're not necessarily going to be able to engage with a standard method of mealtime behavior right away. And so I look at all food opportunities throughout the day. That can be up to 6 to 8 times a day as a time that I can nourish my children. And I've had to take the pressure off myself as a parent and the pressure off my children that they aren't necessarily going to get their full day's worth of vitamin C in one meal. For example, my children get very overwhelmed with multiple foods at a food offering, a meal or snack. So I've then limited to, say, 2 foods, maybe meatballs and pasta. And they aren't really able to engage with more variety than that. But I can offer them a carrot as a snack. And that's a way that I can try and meet their nutrition needs. So we need to look at all those food opportunities as an opportunity to nourish the children.
So when parents are telling us that their children aren't eating their peas, broccoli, the greens, that's maybe because we've got too high expectations on the children at that moment, or
it could be. So for me, my major passion and the foundation of what I like to share with families is looking at regulation. So what is regulation? It all happens in the nervous system, the brain, and it's a way humans assess risk and danger. Now it's a bit unfortunate that the body has evolved, but not necessarily to the point that the body is aware we're out the jungle and there's no lion coming to attack us. But ultimately, the brain is constantly wanting to feel balanced and feel calm. Now, there's lots of different factors that cause that brain to feel calm and balanced. One of them is good blood glucose levels, making sure we're eating regularly. But that's not the only one. Nutritional micronutrients that helps to balance it out, but sleep, physical movement, and for me the most important one is the social emotional connection that we have. So when we look at nutrition and we're looking at mealtime behavior, it is a factor that affects our child's regulation, but there are so many different other factors. Are we making friends with our children? For example, when I had my third child, my poor middle child was thrown into chaos. His world was rocked. And at the same time, he has ADHD and autism, which means rocking his world affects him significantly. And so he was thrown into a quite a significant state of dysregulation. He wasn't feeling safe. He wasn't feeling balanced. And so every morning I had to get out of bed off the ceiling to the baby all night and make friends with him every day, start the day. He didn't have the skill of getting into bed and cuddling. He hadn't developed that skill of tolerating cuddles yet. So I had to get out of bed, even when I was tired, and make friends with him. What did that form? That supported him in his regulation so that we could start to develop sitting at the table, maybe eating completely. Maybe he was feeling so dysregulated, so stressed that he wasn't even able to eat.
Mm.
So we need to consider all those different factors. Some are modifiable, some we can control, like can I engage my child and make them feel loved, make them feel connected. And then there's other factors out of our control. I can't get my child to eat broccoli. Mm. Ironically, I use the example of a carrot as a snack because that's his only vegetable right now.
Mm.
So we need to understand there's so many different factors here. And as a parent, taking that pressure off yourself and saying nutritional food might not be a modifiable factor right now, or not the entirety. We can adjust our expectations. And that's what I've had to do as a parent. And also in terms of that, you know, how do I engage with food and nourishing my family? I need to acknowledge that I have limited executive function, especially after a busy day at work.
Mm.
I'm done.
Mm.
I don't have the ability at that moment to create a big meal, to cook multiple different things. So number one, I don't have the ability to create that meal. And number two, my children are dysregulated because they haven't seen me all day and they need to connect with me.
Mm.
So if that means providing a bowl of cereal as dinner at dinner time while we play Uno, that's okay.
Wow, love that.
So yeah, so, you know, when it comes to meal preparation, I think it's okay to use a mix of make from scratch
mm-hmm.
or pre-prepared. Mm-hmm. So I can boil the potatoes, that I can do, but I can't chop the salad right now.
Mm.
So I buy a packet of salad.
Mm.
Is it a little bit more expensive? Well, yes. But the rotting pumpkin that I have in my fridge currently that I didn't get around to chop is wasting money as well.
Mm.
So trying to find that balance of acknowledging my skills and what my family need and what I need as well to get through that mealtime.
The Empowered Parent with Dana Baltuta's podcast is sponsored by My Therapy House and Dana Baltuta's Coaching, where we work to empower people to be the best they can be for the children they care for. If you would like to find out more, the links to My Therapy House and Dana Baltuta's Coaching websites are in the description below. To contact me, visit my website at danabaltutas.com. And what about children who only like sweets, or, you know, they just always ask for McDonald's, or they always ask for, I want that, I don't know, Oreo cookie, or, you know, tiny teddies.
Yeah.
What about that? Do you, as a dietitian, what's your view on that?
It's such a good question, Donna. I think, and once again, it comes back to that regulation. So what factors affect our food choices and our food-related behavior? It's not only our choices, but how we engage with food. And it comes back to regulation. The child that is only wanting to eat McDonald's fries, they have an intense need for consistency and familiarity. The three different factors that overlap, the different groups of factors that overlap when it comes to regulation, is that social-emotional component. That would be making that loved feeling, that connection, feeling we have friends and feeling connected with our world. Number two is those environmental factors. That's predictability, consistency, and familiarity. Now, when we consider, and the last one then is those physical components. That would be maybe my child has an iron deficiency and they're grumpy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because I didn't give them a hug today. It's because their iron is low. Sleep, the way our body engages with physical movement, sensory integration, all those things form the physical. Now, when it comes to food, all three of those categories affects our food-related behavior. And for the child choosing McDonald's, One of the factors could be sensory factors, that crunch, visual, it looks the same, but then also familiarity and consistency. McDonald's fries are going to be the same every time. Mm. That Jet's cracker is going to look the same every time, and possibly they need to scrummage through the box and find the one that isn't cracked either, because it needs to be round and together before they can bite it. So there's that. There's the social factors. Possibly they remember a time that they ate that Oreo with you and it felt so good, and we sat on the couch and watched a movie and we ate Oreos. For a child who has a rigid brain and a black and white thinking style, that means Oreos are good every time. I want that Oreo.
I want that feeling.
Want that feeling again. Mm-hmm. And then we have those physical factors as well, and we can't discount neurochemicals and the way that food affects our brain. Number one, sugary foods provide a big hit of dopamine. If your child is a dopamine seeker, or their brain is requiring more dopamine, more inclined to ADHD, they will seek out sugar. Until I was medicated for ADHD, I was a sugar addict. Mm. I would need my first sugar hit by 10 o'clock in the morning. Mm. I know adults who have to start the day with a block of chocolate just to get them out of bed. Mm. So sugar has a lot of different factors, as well as, we can maybe discuss it later, other food chemicals. We've got glutamates and MSG, all these other things that we find in food that aren't necessarily good for our brains. They can dysregulate. But at the same time, there's another portion of our brain that craves them. Mm. So if your child is possibly a child that likes twisties, shapes, I'm trying to think, Cheetos, we'll stop there. They might actually be seeking out those food chemicals that are in one way providing a chemical hit for their brain, but not necessarily the best thing for them. So it's really a tricky situation.
So parents who try and make chicken nuggets to emulate McDonald's or Hungry Jack's, and that if the child rejects them, not to take it personally?
No, it's not your cooking skills. For a very rigid thinker, or a child that is needing significant consistency and familiarity, we need to acknowledge that food for them, visually, taste, sensory wise, and just their perception of it, needs to be the same for them to feel safe. That's affecting so many different forms of regulation in that one nugget. And so in that case, we could look at leaving that chicken nugget. It's a good nugget, that one. We'll leave it right there, and we can expose them and support them to develop the skill of eating another consistent food. And for those children in our feeding therapy sessions, I aim towards prepackaged foods only. And prepackaged foods or prepackaged food offerings don't necessarily need to be bad. A lot of my patients, one of their primary safe foods is an up and go. It's consistent. It contains a significant amount of protein. In one high protein up and go, you can meet an 8 to 10 year old's protein needs in one box.
Wow.
Parents are often concerned about protein. Oh, my child, you know, doesn't eat meat or whatever. So in that, we can actually meet their protein needs, we can meet fiber needs, and it's enriched with iron and other micronutrients.
And it's the same all the time.
Well, this is it. It's a consistent offering, but we need to shift our framework from going, it has to be made from scratch. If you are an exceptional chef or a kitchen whiz and you can make it the same, that's great.
Yeah.
I don't have that skill.
I don't either.
That. My air fryer has helped, let me tell you, because it provides that consistent heat. And, that one actually has really been a great tool. But, for those children, it's okay to acknowledge that things need to look the same. and we can maybe leave that food as it is and not adjust that. That would be too stressful for that child.
That's a great idea, isn't it? That they still get their chicken nuggets from wherever they get it from, whether it's McDonald's, Hungry Jack's, or Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know. But they also have different exposure to different foods. I think that's really important. And I really like the way, Sandy, you talk about, you know, prepackaged foods, so like the up and go and that you can find in the supermarket, and then the child can also identify. So let's talk about shopping now, supermarket. A lot of children, when they go to the supermarket, I know parents have said they get very dysregulated, it's very overwhelming. Do you shop with your children, or, you know, how does that all happen? Because obviously it's great that children know where their food comes from, but how do you, you know, how do we overcome some of that, those regulation challenges in the supermarket for some of the kids that we're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. So in my situation, my children are mostly sensory seekers, so they're not completely overwhelmed by the noises, sights and sounds and smells at the grocery store. A point that I want to bring up now is we need to look at motivation. The neurodivergent brain requires a sufficient amount of motivation to get the job done. So when I go to the grocery store, it might be a you know, they need a certain snack. We have our consistency and our familiarity when we go into the grocery store. You always get your Bluey Moo box. That's okay. That's what we do. You sit in the trolley. We can engage with the food. For a child that is food disinterested, it's not necessarily going to be a fun outing for them. Mm. They actually will get quite bored. There's nothing here that's really fun. You're making me walk up and down the aisles. My children have been known to look at the toilet paper aisle as Toilet Paper Mountain. That can be quite fun. But other than that, it can be a really boring place for a food disinterested child. And that might not be the best fit for food exposure for that specific child.
And as you said before, we need to look for opportunities to make friends with our child. So that actually might be a stressful situation.
Could be.
And if we're looking at social, emotional development and regulation as a bank account where we put in and take out, you can't take out from a savings account that you've got nothing in.
So true.
I always say to families, like, we need to put into our savings account that child's social, emotional, heart, soul, whatever it is, and then we can start withdrawing. But don't withdraw more than there is in there, you know?
So true.
Yeah.
And so for some children, engaging with food preparation, you know, I'll chop the carrots while you peel the potatoes, Mum. That's not necessarily a realistic goal for a family. We're buying the carrots pre-cut and us playing Uno at the table while they're sitting on the table, that might be better. And so it's about acknowledging your child's needs, regulation needs, and pairing it with an appropriate food-related environment that will create that positive experience. And that's not necessarily the grocery store. And together with that, maybe I just feel like some quiet time at the grocery store and I don't want to take them with today. Just leave me alone.
That's right. And also you may not have the time to be at the grocery store. You just might want to get in and out. What about shopping at different grocery stores, you know, supermarkets? So I know parents say, oh, we want to expose them to different supermarkets, and you talked about the consistency and routine, it's so important. So I guess for those children it'd be really important to stay within the same supermarket, because then they'd start to know where they're, if the child likes it, where the food is, rather than saying, oh, now we're going to go to, I don't know, Coles and Woolworths and Aldi, then this and that and the other, wherever we are, we'll just pop in. I think sometimes that popping in is also very dysregulating because they're like, oh, I know for me, when I go to a whole different supermarket, I spend 10 minutes looking for something I might find at my local in 30 seconds. So that could also be very dysregulating for children.
Definitely.
Sandy, I also know there are some families that say they come to therapy sessions or whatever, and they go, we'll just pop into the supermarket after the session to get XYZ and before we go home. And I think that's meaningful for you, mum and dad, but for the child, they've just had a really huge session. They just want to go home and relax or have their snack or go jump on the trampoline or sit in front of their favourite show. I think sometimes that's unrealistic, the pop-ins.
Definitely. It's not a positive food exposure experience for the child. And with regards to going to different grocery stores, we need to understand that food and engaging with food, food experiences, is one of the most intense sensory experiences a human can engage with. It encompasses all of our senses, including our hidden internal senses. Mm. And so when it comes to a cognitively inflexible person, someone who needs a lot of familiarity and predictability, food can be exceptionally dysregulating. That strawberry today could be sour, but tomorrow it's sweet. That's not familiar. So food can be very triggering for a sensory sensitive person and a cognitively inflexible person. Now, that's two big whammies right there, two separate aspects of regulation that we're hitting hard. Possibly we could split them a little bit, develop our skills of flexibility outside of that triggering experience of that sensory triggering experience of food. So, for example, my child needs food to be very, the same. Well, how about we practice tolerating variances, tolerating that inconsistency outside of food? Choose a different route to school today. Mm. Let's take a different route. Move the car seat to the other side of the car. Mm. And that's going to feel really uncomfortable. We can talk through that around how things can be different in my sessions and with my therapy children. I love to talk about gray thinking.
Gray area thinking, love it.
Yeah, we put on our black and white mask and we look at the food and go, oh, it's bad because it's the apple has a brown spot on it. The whole apple is bad. We put on our gray thinking and we go, wow, there's a brown spot on that apple. It's not bad. It's just a bit different. That's okay. That's great for some children who are ready for that. But possibly we need to practice that gray thinking, acknowledging things can be different outside of that really triggering food experience. So going to Coles instead of Woolworths, thinking you're helping that child with their flexibility might be a bit overwhelming with them and they're not ready for that just yet.
Talk to me a little bit about parents' individual profiles around food and how that affects us. And I've been talking in other podcasts about our unconscious, and sometimes we're not even aware of the individual differences we have because it's just us. That's what we know. That's what we've grown up with. So does that seep into the meal times? Does that seep into the way we prepare meal times? Does it seep into how we view food, or even like a little facial expression of ours that we're not even aware of? If I look at something and my face might be just a little bit off, the child might really just grasp that and go, "Mummy doesn't like that, so that means that's not safe." Is that something that you come across?
Oh, definitely. I think as a parent, it's so easy to feel like a failure when my child is not meeting the expected norm for food range or food-related behavior. And that causes a parent to maybe feel like a failure. And then that could cause them to put additional pressure on themselves and on the child to shift our food-related behavior. Mm. And it's our children are highly sensitive to our moods and, like you say, even our facial expressions. It's easy for us to do what I say, but not as I do.
Yes.
And so we need to really evaluate our own feelings associated with food. What was our upbringing? You eat what's on your plate and you don't get up until it's finished.
Mm.
Feeling as a failure as a parent. That's two separate things there. We need to acknowledge that our children's food-related behavior is not indicative of our love for them or how we care for them or the effort we've put in. We can put in exceptional amount of hours of therapy, of all the things at home, but their skills might be developing at a different rate to what you would hope.
Mm.
And together with that is our preconceived ideas and our perceptions around food and how we were brought up. I don't think acknowledging our children's needs is a soft approach to parenting.
Mm.
I don't think we need to look back and say, this is how I did it as a child.
Mm.
It's okay to do things different. And it's okay to acknowledge that possibly that felt really uncomfortable to you.
Mm.
I tell all my patients, as a family, we still laugh about the time my dad shoved the beans down my sister's throat. No one forgot that time. Wasn't a pleasant time.
I think we've all had one of those experiences in our past.
I've done it to my own child in the past too. We get pushed as parents.
Mm.
And it's because of our deep desire to do it in a way that we think is right, or we want things to be a certain way because we've deemed that is right. And we need to look carefully at our expectations of ourselves and of our children and expectations of our life and what that's going to look like.
Mm. And I think, I think the perception of therapy is changing in the neurodiverse world. You know, we're moving away from just the black and white behavior therapy, just in general, and we're moving more towards that social emotional relationship gray therapy where we're really looking at interaction, connection first. And I think that's the way food is moving too. Like you said, it's all about the relationship, you know. So if the child feels safe and comfortable and just right, not only with their external senses, but also in their, what we call the interception. So inside, so it could be that they've got, I always ask, when did they last have a bowel movement? Or, you know, have they got some gastric reflux? Or have they got anxiety? Or are they really, really tired? All that interception does affect the way, I know it affects the way I look at food.
So true, yes.
And I sometimes say, look, I just want pasta with cheese today. I don't feel like crunching my salads. And, you know, I might be have neurodiversity in different areas, but I know with food I'm pretty neurotypical, quote unquote. But I just think about our kids and they can't actually describe that or explain that to us. So that's really important, right?
Yeah, it's so true. So the mainstream preferred method of feeding a family is called division of responsibility. We shorten it to DOR. Mm. Division of responsibility is a great framework to provide consistency at meal times, which is great for families, right? Mm-hmm. We want consistency and familiarity, understanding that all children, neurotypical or neurodiverse, respond well to boundaries and consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that rule and framework of feeding a family dictates that the parent decides the what, when, and where. All right? What? This is the food that's available right now at this feeding time. The when? No, you're not having Cheetos. It's 10 minutes to dinner time. We're eating at 6 o'clock. Okay? Mm-hmm. And where? We're going to eat at the dinner table tonight. This is where we eat our meals. All right. The child decides whether they're going to eat the food and how much.
Mm-hmm.
You can't dictate to the child how much they need to eat. Mm. How can you determine, like you've just mentioned, interoception? You can't determine what the child is feeling internally. And so we can't say, you haven't eaten enough. you need to take 3 more spoons. Okay. So that is an amazing framework. It works beautifully to provide that consistency that everyone in the household knows their responsibility when it comes to mealtime food behavior. Okay. The challenge is when we add in neurodiversity and understanding that the neurodivergent individual struggles with regulation. As parents, then we need to be really sensitive to that. So we can still use DOR as a framework, but we need to provide some flexibility, understanding that, okay, I had already organized that all meals happen at the dinner table. This is the parent's role. But my 6-year-old has just started reception. He has to spend a significant part of the day sitting. He's tired. He's jiggly. And so for him, we can be flexible and say, Benji, I know that we planned to sit at the table tonight, but I can see that you're feeling really jiggly. How about we do one bite and then 10 jumps on the trampoline and then you come back again? I'm still in control as the parent. My responsibility was to decide where, but I've taken into account my child's regulation needs and that then can provide that flexibility. At the same time, through that, we're modeling flexibility. We're showing our children that we can adapt and be flexible because our neurodivergent children are potentially very rigid in their thinking. And we can model that and show empathy and show that flexibility to them that they can then start to adapt as well and take on. And that would be that neuroaffirming approach, like you said, saying, I can see your needs. I can see that this is really hard. I can see that we're all, it's a big hot mess now. Guys, let's have a TV dinner. That's okay. The standard rule is no screens at dinner time, no distractions. Let's focus on the food. Well, right now I can see my family is going to have a horrible time at the dinner table. Let's put the TV on. Mum decided the what, where, and when, but I did take into account my children's needs.
That's right. You read the room.
Yeah. And that is then we take it back to regulation, and it's so important that a parent at the start of their journey pieces together those regulation puzzle pieces for each individual child. And sometimes we need to be flexible with each individual child. For example, my one child is growth faltering. He's lost significant weight since starting stimulants for ADHD, Ritalin. And so he needs multiple food offerings after school time. So instead of having a snack and then dinner and then bed, I need to provide food offerings for him hourly after school until bedtime. My other child eats his way through every feeling he feels and regulates with eating like his mother. And he's needing to be supported to develop some alternative regulation strategies and steered away from eating hourly after school because he's tired. And so we have different needs, and it's okay to talk about our different needs and acknowledge the different needs in the household. And it's not about being unfair. We can communicate that we all have different needs to our children.
I love the way that you talk about the meaning of food and also talk about the meaning of food to your children in a way that they understand, and also help them understand what helps them with their food, because then they become empowered kids.
Amazing.
Because they will now know that, oh, at home I do a few jumps in between spoons or in between bites or whatever. So they can then advocate for themselves and say, hey, I need to do a few jumps now. Yes. And that way they are really understanding who they are and how what their relationship with food is, which I think is so important. And I love the way, Sandy, you were talking about the middle child, or, you know, who's eating to regulate emotion. And I think, again, we don't talk about that with children enough. As adults, we know this because we realize that's what we do.
Yes.
But how wonderful is it that the child is starting to understand, yep, food is one of my regulators, but there are other ways I can regulate myself as well. So before I choose food, is there any other way? Oh, no, nothing else is going to do it. I'm actually just going to, I'm going to have something to eat, you know.
Yes, yeah, which is fine. And as adults, I think we've all sat down to a box of chocolates.
Yes.
It's okay to use that as a tool.
Yes.
But it's okay to have a variety of different tools in our toolbox.
Yes, yes.
And be empowered to know what's in our toolbox to use. And having those, that open communication. And at the same time, understanding that my one child needs to, provide his body with more energy to maintain his weight, and the other one needs to be careful to not take in too much energy, more than what his body needs. Mm. We never talk about weight. We don't say skinny. Well, we don't say fat. We just say what your body needs, and your body needs to be balanced, and we want to work towards that, and not talk discussing weight, or especially often the children I work with would be more on the side of needing to take in more food to maintain a healthy weight or growth pattern. I don't weigh my patients. I don't like to do growth monitoring. I just make sure that they're either checking in with their GP regularly or their pediatrician, as long as someone's monitoring it. But I would prefer not to do that, because I would hate there to be this association with food in relation to our weight. It can add pressure or stigma, or create a mindset for the child that I would prefer not to be there.
And
life will provide that for them later, and let's hold off for as long as we can.
That's right. And I think that could be part of the medical exam anyway, because they're going to the doctor or pediatrician, and that's what they do. Mm. And if they need to take bloods to see what the chemicals are in the blood, you know, and what they need, etc. I could talk about this for forever. I love
so
this.
Like I say, being neurodivergent it's not a bad thing.
No.
It has amazing strengths. And one of them is having really special interests.
And passion.
And passion. We're passionate people.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, so it's great.
I love it. So, Sandy, many studies about neurodivergent individuals relate to gut issues, the gut and the brain. And sometimes they talk about picky or fussy eaters and about their gut. And, you know, I know a lot of the people that I have that I see that are neurodivergent, they've got lots of gut issues. They've got lots of flatulence. They don't have bowel movements, you know, often, or, you know, there's all these things around the gut. Could you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah,
the gut and the brain, and how we can help the gut.
Yeah, so this is also a huge passion for me, and I might be biased in thinking that focusing on the gut as a main focus to treat some of the more undesirable symptoms that our children are experiencing, you know, I feel like this is a key point. So being neurodivergent often relates to having a slightly heightened sense of arousal. So because of that constant dysregulation, trying to seek regulation, your body functions at a slightly higher level of stress. We take it back to the lion in the jungle. The neurodivergent body is basically always prepared to fight the lion. There's higher levels of stress hormones that have been found in neurodivergence. So that would be things like cortisol and adrenaline. Now, if you think when you are feeling stressed and your adrenaline is flowing, consider yourself in a jungle with a lion. your body causes blood to flow away from non-essential functions at that time and go towards your extremities so you can feel faster and stronger to attack the lion. What does that mean? Blood flows away from the digestive system when you're stressed, all right? Acute stress, you know, digestion slows down, blood flows away, so you can engage with that stressful experience. For the neurodivergent who has a slightly higher level of stress hormones consistently, we would see that digestion is affected. It is slowed down slightly, or you know, there's less efficient processes happening consistently. Together with that, some medications that neurodivergents take, for example, stimulants, increases cortisol levels as well. So that can affect your gut as well. How it affects your gut is, number one, it can either slow down or speed up movement of food through your gut. That could relate to constipation, diarrhea. So, for example, Christmas time, my child's gut paws for the whole of December. Right. He is so excited about Christmas, and that excitement increases his level of arousal and cortisol levels, and he gets diarrhea for a month. Together with that, when digestion slows down, we see an increase in IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, symptoms. All right, we call it functional bowel disorder in children. And that could be, let's think, all right, so things slow down, digestion is slowing down, that food is in there for potentially a longer time, it starts to rot. And rotten food makes gas. And that gas relates to bubbles in the gut that feels painful, that looks like bloating, distension, gas, flatulence. It can also relate to a foul-smelling breath as well. If you think of what rotten food would smell like, it can come out the top. Reflux, indigestion, which I like to just explain as yuck. You just feel yuck on the inside. Now, any of those things would obviously cause a child or anyone to avoid food. So we consider all those sensory aspects, all those aspects of regulation. And on top of that, your child might actually just be feeling so yuck on the inside. And it creates this incredible disinterest in food, avoidance. And so looking at the gut and identifying what are the foods that exacerbate that, how can we look at some of the carbohydrate foods that contain sugars that make a lot of bubbles. Those would be called our FODMAPs. If people have heard of those before. So we can try to determine which of those foods causes the most discomfort. We can try to work towards eliminating those. At the same time, that stress can also affect our gut microbiome. Those are the good bacteria that live in our gut. Now, this is the, you know, in the last few years, I want to say 10 to 15 years, the evidence is really starting to come up very strongly of the significant effect of the gut on brain function and overall health. Those bugs living in your stomach, in your gut, in your intestine, weigh more than your brain. That's significant. That's a whole organ. Wow. We can consider it as an organ. And should we not be caring for that organ? Now, those stress hormones kill the gut bugs. We're attacking them all the time. So it's almost expected that neurodivergents will experience some gut challenges. So we've got that gut microbiome we need to care for. The gut microbiome can make up to 80% of serotonin that the brain needs. Serotonin's our happy hormone. We need to look after those guys. If they're getting obliterated by cortisol daily, we need to make sure we're sending backup. And how do we do that? We feed that gut microbiome with food. Prebiotics, fiber. Guess what? That's the fruit and vegetables. Our children, it's not their naturally preferred food potentially. as well as probiotic enriched foods or a probiotic supplement. There's a lot of evidence coming out on the effect of autistic symptoms. I don't like to consider it a medical condition, but there can be increased symptoms, and looking at the effect of probiotic supplementation on lowering some of those symptoms, aggression, head banging, etc., things like those neurological effects, quite significant. And so, yeah, protecting that gut microbiome, looking at that, acknowledging that potentially our children haven't developed the skill to eat a wide variety of fiber-containing foods. So we can provide that in supplementation that helps with that trigger point for the parents. Right? You can, this is what you can do. This is controllable right now for your child. So we've got the movement of food through the gut is affected. The gut microbiome is affected. And together with that, we have food chemicals that I've already mentioned and the way that they can affect the nervous system. The example I like to use is if you think of a mosquito bite, it's a little red mark, little round circle. What happens if you scratch it? It gets red and itchy. And the more you scratch it, the more red and itchy it gets, right?
Yes.
For some people, when you ingest some of these food chemicals, it's almost like scratching that red itchy bite. They are amplifiers or
irritators.
They tickle the nervous system. That can create an immune response. What's happening at that itchy bite site? The immune system is sending blood and histamine, all these things to try and protect that. That can happen from food as well. And that itchy bite could be in your brain. And so that can cause neurological symptoms. It can also cause an immune response. We can see hives, eczema, rashes, increase in diarrhea and constipation and gut symptoms. You can have an immune response in your gut. So was it the IBS? Was it the bubbles in the sugary foods? Or was it possibly some other food chemicals that are affecting that gut in a double whammy? In some cases, it could be all of the above. The gut, the IBS and the food reactions.
So how would parents find that out? Who would they need to see? What professional would they need to see?
So dietitians then and nutritionists are the specialists in that. A lot of parents, and I completely understand it, tend towards alternative therapies and looking at alternative tests to determine what are the irritants that are affecting their children. It's not medically substantiated. And the gold standard for identifying what are the gut amplifiers is elimination diets, which ultimately means you cut out everything and you introduce it one at a time. Now, this isn't practical or sustainable for a child that potentially has 10 to 15 foods. It's not realistic right now. So this is then where your trained dietitian or nutritionist would work with the family to modify some of these great strategies we have to make it more practical. So keeping a food diary. For example, if I give my child a Zupa Dupa, they cannot contain the neurological response. They literally scream out loud, not out of anger, but just out of trying to regulate, trying to release some of that energy. Cheetos. Oh, what did I buy? I bought Cheetos the other day for my children. They were little animals after that. So then I can work backwards and say, wow, all right, let me go look. What do I have in the Zupa Dupa? Colorants, probably. And the Cheetos, MSG. It's that yellow. The yellow snacks is often one of the major culprits. Okay, I'm going to try and avoid those for a while and see if I see the animal come out again. And so we can sometimes work backwards. We work as detectives. It's a tough job for the parent because there's so many different factors affecting regulation. So that would be the ideal. But let's remember, Donna, let's be kind on ourselves as parents. If Cheetos is one of your child's main foods, you can acknowledge that this is affecting their brain, but right now it might not be a modifiable factor.
Mm.
And that's okay. My son, I know that he's very sensitive to dairy mm-hmm. and soy, and I'm not sure gluten or not. I haven't been able to determine it yet
mm.
because he wasn't in a sufficiently regulated state to actually be able to remove that. Understanding that he's the middle child and food has got a social aspect. If I exclude him from dairy milk when the rest of the family is drinking dairy milk, he's going to feel more disconnected.
Mm.
That affects his regulation.
Mm.
So we haven't been at a point right now that we've been able to target some of those adverse food reactions.
Mm.
And I've been focusing on other aspects of regulation,
mm.
knowing that they all play a part. And we've now reached a point that he's able to do that. For some parents, it's within their ability to do it from early on or where they are right now. For some people, we need to acknowledge, for parents saying, it's okay, and possibly this is something we can work towards maybe in teenagehood
mm.
when your child can actually take ownership of it.
Mm, I love that. I love that. It's a journey.
It's a journey.
It's not an overnight fix
no.
or anything like that. It's a journey.
Yeah.
We're running out of time,
oh,
but
of
I
course.
Absolutely love this.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you back, Sandy, to talk more because we haven't covered quite a few things.
Yeah.
But I want you just to maybe quickly talk about helping parents manage their expectations
yeah.
around food,
yeah.
you know, like, so how, and, you know, I know that people have a goal that I'd like that, you know, my child sits down at the family meal and we all have a family meal at Christmas time and this is the goal and this is what we're working towards, or that they're going to be able to eat at childcare or at kindy. You know, how can we, I guess, develop realistic goals for our children? Because I sometimes see the NDIS goals that come through and I think, oh, we need to work on some of those foundation skills. And I guess, you know, I am a relationship-based therapist, so I'm very much biased against, you know, towards that, building relationships first. What would be something you would say to a parent about managing their expectations and looking after themselves, I guess, around fussy or picky eaters?
Yeah, I think goal setting is so important, Donna, because when we make quite specific goals, it helps to manage our expectations. So we think about it as climbing a ladder. Number one would be to acknowledge where we are now. So at the moment, I'm writing a book. It's a six-step process. And number one is defining the challenge, okay? You need to acknowledge, okay, where are we now? What would I like to change? What do I want to see? Possibly you do need someone to help you with that if you're not maybe quite sure. You're in a big fat mess and not sure. But also then acknowledging where you've come from already. Let's just acknowledge the progress that you've made, because that helps us to remember that when we put a bit of, you know, when we do some work, we do see progress.
Mm,
right?
Mm.
So we have our position currently. Okay, and then we need to look at what we call SMART goals. We do this with all our patients. It's specific goals. So we've defined the problem. I would like my child to eat up to 5 different building foods, protein type mm. foods. Okay, so measurable. Well, let's see. Currently, he eats 2. All right, so we want to make 3. So that would be SMART, specific, measurable, attainable. Is this something that would be realistic to you? Would it be realistic for you to expect your child to sit at the table for 40 minutes? No. Let's look at it as attainable. Okay, well, 40 minutes is a bit much. Maybe we'll start with 3 minutes. Okay, that's attainable. And so we've got specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, as well, it's within my child's skill set to get there. Or maybe in the future, this is where we want to get. And the T is for time-based. So I love to do this with my the parents that I see, because often they'll say, I want my child to eat five different vegetables, five different food, and five different building foods. Sure, no problem. Let's set a time, and that time will probably be 5 years. So when that really helps, when we break it down, each challenge we've identified, it helps us to manage our expectations. The acknowledgement is that those fruit and vegetables are going to take 5 to 10 years to potentially establish, or 6 months. Let's assess the situation. And that can really help. And acknowledging that your progress, and that we will see progress. Together with that, what we haven't mentioned, and I really want to mention today, is support. We cannot do this, and my slogan for my my individual business is education. Sure, you know Cheetos are gonna, you know, make your child a wild animal. Motivation, what would cause you to when he's whining for Cheetos to say no? You know, do you know? And then support, ongoing support. As parents, this is a tough journey. We need ongoing support from your therapists, from family members, from friends. We need to talk out about these things. We need to seek out support, social support, because we can't do it alone. Those three aspects are how we can manage our journey as parents with our neurodivergent children.
Oh, I love that. And I love that you talk about that. It's like I always say, it takes a village.
Yeah.
It's not just we do it individually. And I do think that even the thought of food sometimes triggers different things for different people, yes. For parents. And, you know, people have expectations of themselves, what they should eat, how much they should eat. And, like, we've all got different relationships around food. And and then we sometimes relay that to our children, you know. So I think it's also about finding out about ourselves more, being compassionate with ourselves, knowing that we're learning people and that we can transform all the time. We always change. And I know that I've learned a lot on this podcast. And I'm hoping that you come back, and I'm hoping that parents also write in some questions and maybe we can address them as well, because I think I wouldn't like to see food just compartmentalized to dietetics or nutritionists. You know, food is everywhere. Yes. It's like communication is not just compartmentalized to speech pathologists. Communication is everywhere. So the more we find out about food and the more we find out about how we can be realistic around food, that's what I learned today, was that you, Sandy, as a dietitian and a parent, you're very practical and realistic. And I think often parents come in and they've had advice and the advice is somewhere out in the never never, you know, somewhere else in the universe, and they don't know how to apply it in everyday life. So thank you so, so, so much, Sandy, for coming in. I hope this is, I'm sure it will be very helpful for parents. And again, another step to supporting parents to become empowered. And I will leave your website on the comments below. And then if parents have any more questions, they can ask me and we'll figure it out.
Yeah, that's so fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Dana. Great. We'll chat again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. And I hope you found the information in this podcast useful. Please like, share, and subscribe. Be sure to listen next week for more information about getting empowered to be the best you can be for the child you care for. If you are interested in finding out more about your unique self and situation and to be coached by me, Dana Baltudis, please contact me via my website in the description below. And remember, you stay empowered by learning more about yourself, staying true to yourself, and therefore true to your child. By being empowered, you bring out the best in yourself, which brings out the best in your child.